This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, May 28th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. As the coronavirus pandemic enters its fourth month, Americans are getting baffling mixed messages about the economy. In the past 10 weeks or so, more than 40 million people have filed for unemployment benefits, the highest number since the Great Depression. More than 100,000 people have died from the virus in the United States, the highest toll in the world, and the country is still reporting an average of 1,000 deaths every day. Still, states are beginning to reopen, the stock market is rising, and economists are optimistic that the economy will quickly rebound. In April, Jason Furman, one of President Obama's key economic advisors, startled officials of both parties by predicting, "We're about to see the best economic data we've seen in the history of this country." The Trump administration, unsurprisingly, has been saying the same thing. Last week, Kevin Hassett, a senior economic advisor to Trump, told CNBC,
"The real-time stuff that we look at, like the number of businesses opened and things like that, it's really gone up quite a bit because the economy's getting going again. And so I think that the question is not really like when does the recovery start, because, you know, absent a second wave of the disease, it's kind of already begun. You're already seeing a pickup. You know, the question is how long does it take to get back to January, right, that level of GDP? And I think that definitely you're looking at a very strong third quarter, a very strong fourth quarter, and probably a great next year. And so I guess I disagree that it's going to take all the way through the end of 2021 with Jay.
John Cassidy, a New Yorker staff writer who covers politics and economics, joins me to discuss how to think about the long-term effects of the pandemic on the U.S. and world economies, and how the country's widespread reopening of businesses and schools could determine the winner of the 2020 presidential election. John, welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me on, Dorothy. Very pleased to be here.
You know, the last time we spoke at the beginning of April, it seemed almost impossible that a rapid recovery could take place. Paul Krugman, who's been a very consistent critic of the Trump administration, he's a Nobel Prize winner in economics and an op-ed columnist at the Times, wrote in late February that maybe Trump and America will be lucky and this won't be as bad as it might be. But anyone feeling confident right now isn't paying attention. But yesterday, he told Bloomberg News that he doesn't anticipate a major depression or anything like the 2007 to 2009 recession, saying people expecting the slump to look like the last one seem to me to be fighting the last war. So what has changed?
Well, a couple of things, I think, Dorothy. Number one, we've had an enormous policy response. People who don't follow this stuff closely, I think, underestimate it. We've had a $3 trillion stimulus package from Congress, which is more than three times the size of the stimulus package we saw in 2009. If you remember back then, the Republicans in Congress and even some conservative Democrats were worried about the size of the stimulus, and the Obama administration settled at sort of $800 million. This is $3 trillion and rising. It looks like we'll have another emergency spending package next month, even though the two sides are now fighting about it. So that's a huge fiscal boost to the economy. Then on the monetary side, the Federal Reserve Board has been printing money at unprecedented rates to buy financial assets of all kinds and to lend money to corporations, which it's never done before. So the federal government, through the Federal Reserve and the Congress, built what it's commonly referred to as a bridge for a couple of months, which has made the downturn, even though there's been enormous downturn in employment, when the unemployment rate comes out next week for May, it'll probably be more than 20%. But the consensus among economists is that so far, at least, the policies that have been put in place have prevented a downward spiral into a sort of Great Depression scenario. Of course, in absolute terms and just in human terms, there's still a lot of terrible things happening in the economy. And I was driving through Brooklyn yesterday. I saw people queuing up to get food packages. This is happening all over the country. So, you know, we shouldn't get too optimistic here. The markets and the professional economists are reflecting the fact that an absolute disaster at the moment seems to have been avoided. But as I've been writing about, nothing's for sure yet.
So what about the lessons from the Great Recession? Did we strengthen the economy in ways that have made it possible to spring back more quickly?
Well, we've learned from the Great Depression and the Great Recession that you need a very aggressive policy response when the economy slumps. And I think one of the factors which is underrated here is that the Democrats and the Republicans agreed on it. And so that's why we got such a big policy response. If there had been a Democratic president in the White House when this happened, I very much doubt that the Republicans in Congress would have agreed to a $3 trillion stimulus package. They would have been talking about deficit reduction and, you know, we can't increase federal spending by this. But there was actually, for a couple of months there in March and April, or maybe even 1 month, there was a consensus on Capitol Hill that we had to forget about all the stuff about deficit reduction and rising debt and just do whatever was necessary to prevent a huge economic collapse.
And Furman told Politico that he's now looking at the recovery more like what we see after a natural disaster, a hurricane or an industry-wide event like the Gulf of Mexico oil spill.
Right. Well, Furman is taking an optimistic line here. I'm not sure I agree with him to the optimistic extent that he's talking about. He is basically assuming that from here on in, we don't have any more spikes in the virus itself, so that the reopening and the return to work can proceed relatively uninterrupted. I was just looking at a few figures yesterday. The number of people passing through airline terminals has doubled, which sounds impressive, but it's still down 87%. The number of truckloads being hauled across the country was up 27% last week, but that's still down 70 or 80% from the previous level. You know, you've got to look at these figures carefully. They look very impressive, but we're still bouncing along the bottom. The markets are reflecting the fact that we're not going down any further, it seems, at the moment. But that could all turn around if the virus comes back and we have a second wave.
Well, exactly. And that, I mean, we've all seen the pictures of people partying, you know, side by side in swimming pools and on beaches without masks. It's a pretty big presumption that there's not going to be a second wave.
I mean, I'm not an epidemiologist. I think what you can say is that what we've seen so far from the reopenings in Florida, Georgia, and Texas, which started a few weeks ago, we've seen a tick up in cases in a couple of those states, but we haven't seen a huge takeoff yet. People are extrapolating from that and assuming that because things haven't gone terribly wrong in these states so far, it's not going to produce a huge second wave. I think we just don't know about that. There's just huge uncertainty. There are some states like Alabama and Maine where the cases do seem to be rising alarmingly. So I think at the moment, as I say, the markets and some economists are taking a very optimistic view, and that could turn out to be true. And I don't think we're ever going to get a rebound as rapidly as you do from a natural disaster, because even if things go very well, things like the travel industry and the entertainment industry are still going to be hit. I don't think there's any way that, you know, 95% of the public or 90% even of the public are going to want to fly again in October or go to the theatre or anywhere where the large crowds are gathered. So I think to that extent, the sort of V-shaped recovery argument that people are making is very optimistic.
So, John, China and parts of Europe have been reopening their economies a little bit ahead of us. How much success have they had in getting things to return to pre-pandemic normalcy? And are there parallels to be drawn here?
Well, I think I'd say a couple of things. Number one, it's sort of encouraging. China is 2 months ahead of us, really. Germany and other places maybe 3 or 4 weeks ahead of us. And they've done a staged reopening. The optimistic reading is that the economic figures have bounced back, as they obviously do when you get people back to work. Also, there hasn't been a big rebound in cases in these countries. Now, they have very different health systems and very different testing and tracing systems to what we do. The downside to all that is, even after a couple of months, the Chinese economy is still nowhere near at the levels that it was prior to the pandemic. Most of the statistics show it's perhaps operating at sort of 80%. Europe, for once, actually seems to be taking some policies. This week, the EU introduced a new sort of cross-border stimulus package, which was encouraging. So, I think the message is that there is certainly going to be some rebound, but it's too early to, you know, assume that this is a sort of going to be all over in a couple of months and we'll have a V-shaped recovery and we'll be back to normal.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
There's been some really strong reporting about, in wake of the stimulus packages, about a number of quite undeserving big corporations that have gotten federal grants and loans. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, this is on the fiscal side. The Congress and the administration basically approved bailouts for anything which was deemed, any companies which were deemed important to national security. And they included all the airlines and the airline manufacturers in that, for example. So you saw a company like American Airlines and Delta Airlines getting big bailouts with very few strings attached, even though these companies have been extremely profitable for the last 10 years. And then there's another program operating through the Fed for smaller companies and mid-market companies, which has been widely abused as well. As you say, companies like the Lakers, some of Donald Trump's donors have got them. This program operated through the banks, and the banks seem to have given the first loans to the well-established clients, well-connected clients, while a lot of the small business who is intended to went to the back of the line. I think what you're going to see in the months ahead, as we get more information about all these programs, is that there was quite a bit of graft involved in them. But that was sort of inevitable, and I think the people who designed it knew that. That was just sort of a price you paid. The government basically said, here are blank checks for businesses to keep people employed. And they said, you know, we're just going to have to take some abuses of these programs. The question is, could they have designed them differently? Along the lines that a lot of European countries designed them through direct wage subsidies, etc., as I and lots of other people were arguing at the time.
And what about these bankruptcies, JCPenney, J. Crew, Pier 1 Imports, and Hertz? And I noticed that Hertz had laid off half of its staff in the past few months, but at the same time paid out over $16 million in bonuses to its top executives just before declaring bankruptcy.
Yes, well, Hertz is another one of these companies which borrowed extreme amounts of money even before the crisis. I think they had $18 billion of debt or so on their balance sheets. They did a private equity buyout more than a decade ago. So they brought a lot of this on themselves. But at the same time, you know, they're a car rental company, so their business basically went down 100% at the start of this crisis. I think the larger argument here is the optimistic story is that everything's going to rebound. All the companies that were you know, I've just laid people off, we're going to take things back. Okay, some sectors, a few sectors like restaurants and theatres and airlines might struggle for some time, but generally the economy will come back. But that really is ignoring the danger that a lot of these companies are never going to come back, or if they do come back, are going to come back at much lower levels of employment and revenues than they had. Also, I think, and I've been writing about this, I think there's a residual danger in the financial markets. Even though the Fed has been pumping money in at unprecedented rates, there are still parts of the financial markets, the highly leveraged, high debt parts of the market, which haven't been bailed out, leveraged loans.
Well, and that is reminiscent of what brought on the Great Recession.
It's very reminiscent of it. I mean, the CLOs, which I wrote about earlier this week, are basically the cousins of the CDOs, which blew up in 2008. The Federal Reserve is very aware of this. They've, you know, Jerome Powell gave a speech about the dangers of these products.
The head of the Federal Reserve.
Head of the Federal Reserve, a return to sort of dangerous lending practices. The danger is that all these bad loans come back onto the banking system. The banks then look like they may go under. You then get a huge panic, which is what you got in 2008. And that can bring down the entire system if you get unfortunate, which is what happened in the Great Depression. There are two differences. One, the banks are certainly stronger than they were in 2008, but also the Fed has acted preemptively, basically becoming a lender of last resort to vast sections of the economy, including basically the entire financial sector. But the danger is if they get into serious problems and look like they're going to start infecting the rest of the financial system, what will the Fed do then?
And once again, we're seeing the fault lines of extreme economic inequality in this country. And it's interesting to see how Joe Biden's campaign is sounding a lot more like Elizabeth Warren's was during the primaries. And it's pretty clear, is it not, that if the optimistic predictions are correct and the economy is returning to pre-pandemic form just in time for the presidential election, that's going to be a huge boon for Trump and pose major messaging problems for Biden.
Well, it is. That's the sort of firm an argument. I mean, the counter to that is, even if things go very well, let's say there isn't a huge new spike in cases and the reopening proceeds pretty much as planned, most economists still think that by October, November, the unemployment rate would still be at like, but in double figures, 10, 12%. That would be higher than it reached in 2009. Trump's going to be making the argument, look, it's coming down, it could have been worse, could have been the Great Depression, we saved the world. But there's still going to be a lot of suffering out there. The economy is still going to be in trouble. And I find it very practically inconceivable the stock market is going to keep going up as people realize that we're going to have mass unemployment for a long time. Trump will be very lucky if the stock market keeps going up in a straight line until November. As you say, it's going to be a messaging issue, but I don't think we can't assume sitting here in May that, it's all going to be tickety-boo for Trump in October and September. We just don't know. There's massive uncertainty here.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He writes a column about politics and economics for NewYorker.com and is the author of How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.